Legend has it that when Cortes landed in Mexico in the 1500s, he ordered his men to burn the ships that had brought them there to remove the possibility of doing anything other than going forward into the unknown. Has COVID ushered in a similarly decisive moment for traditional print media companies to burn the printing presses for print products? The hard lockdown since the middle of March has been punishing, to say the least. The economic shock of COVID-19 has wreaked havoc on parts of South Africa's print industry, contributing to the closure of Associated Media Publishing, which includes iconic titles Cosmo, Woman on Wheels, and House and Leisure. Caxton and CTP Publishers and Printers, meanwhile, announced in early May that it's begun the process of withdrawing from magazine publishing, although Living and Loving and Farmers Weekly may be accommodated elsewhere in the stable. And just this week, Media 24 became the latest to announce the closure of physical print titles. Five magazines and two newspapers, including the legendary Drum magazine. What Jim Bailey must be thinking. The group said it would retain readership, but only in digital format. Afrikaans publications like Die Burger, Oorskop and Volksblad will still be available 5 days a week. So what does the future hold for print journalism and print media? Professor Anton Harbour, Caxton Professor of Journalism at Wits University, joins us now, along with Chris Buerter, the Managing Director of The Media Shop, one of the country's best media agencies, and Pule Molebaledi, MD for News and Media at Arena, which is the holding company of this station and one of Africa's largest English language news publishers in print, with very well-known titles, including The Sunday Times, The FM, The Business Day, The Herald, and The Daily Dispatch, and also owns a number of B2B and B2C magazines as well. So, Prof, kick us off. I've loved print for as long as I can remember. The touch and feel of a glossy magazine, the finished piece, being able to carry it around with me and flip through the pages. I love the work and talent that goes into creating a printed magazine and how they're limited as well. But I've had to stop and really think about what it now means, the fear of a virus living on the pages of something that I found comfort in with a coffee for so many years. And I hope this isn't lost for good. And I hope that one day we can enjoy the artwork and the articles. But for now, I think I'm going to continue to just consume things online. And I think this is a trend that we're seeing amongst most consumers. And the big question now is certainly, how will this impact the consumption of magazines, not just now, but into the future?
You're absolutely right that when we lose magazines, we lose something very distinctive. I mean, there's nothing like the tactile and visual impact of a the strong use of photographs, those visual elements. There's no doubt we're losing something special there that isn't easily reproduced online. One can do great things online, but different things in different ways. What has happened is that we've seen, you know, these magazines and the magazine industry here was at their peak some time ago. And there's been a deterioration because of the impact of the internet and social media and digital communications. But the impact of the pandemic on advertisers and readers is such that it's accelerated, it's massively accelerated the deterioration of the magazine industry and is creating havoc across the media industry generally. Some magazines will survive, as with books, while printed books, the numbers went down significantly for, 20, 25 years. They seem to have hit a position where there's now stability between e-books and printed books. So some magazines will survive. My guess will be they probably will be the more high-end ones, the more international ones. The ones that work best in print and won't work well online, some of those will still survive, but there's no doubt we're going through a major change with an accelerated move to digital consumption of all media.
Yeah, and I think of those specialist publications like the National Geographic there, Prof, when you talk about those that will survive, because they have this ability to live as a coffee table book on a coffee table in the house somewhere, whereas others probably are a little bit more text and content heavy. Chris, as a media strategist, how have you seen COVID-19 changing our behavior patterns and our consumption of, in particular, magazines. And we'll talk about media in general a little bit later, but magazines firstly.
Well, I think the biggest challenge that magazines has faced, and the prof touched on it just now, is that if you go look at the, and let's go look at the real lifeblood of what magazines are made up out of. Almost every single magazine in South Africa is, for the most part, funded by advertising revenue. If you go back 20 years, I remember print advertising as a whole used to make up 40% of advertising. Currently, it makes up about 12, 13% of advertising. So print as a platform has been losing ad revenue hand over fist for the past 20 years, as I think we all know. The problem was now with what this virus has brought about is a massive, massive cut in advertising budgets. So for the most part, most media platforms are struggling. We'll talk about it a little bit later on, but the likes of Facebook are struggling, Google are struggling. Both of those released cautionaries in their financial results. And if those guys are struggling, you can imagine the impact on print. You know, so it's almost a bit like, you know, the virus attacks people who have immune deficiencies and who are already weak. In the same way, the virus has attacked businesses that were weak. And the print industry has been weak for a while now. Now, with this massive loss of money out the industry, a lot of businesses have just said, listen, to here no further.
Yeah, it is an accelerant to the prof's earlier point on those trends that were there pre-COVID. And we know that print was weak pre-COVID. Pule, how are you seeing COVID reshaping the way consumers engage with the arena's titles?
I mean, for us, it's been an interesting journey of discovery because, you know, we just came in as new owners into this business, and we had lofty ideas and plans on, you know, how we're going to be doing things. And we thought we had about 7 years or so, which was contracted into 3 months, you know. So the things that we had to basically, you know, think that we're going to have a headroom on was just basically taken away. Underlining what the prof has just basically said on the magazine side, my view on that one is that, you know, that COVID has basically exposed the fault lines of the business models of magazines. Even before we got into this environment, if you recall, there were a number of magazines that were closing because they were obviously operating in an environment where they had very serious overheads and also struggling with a bit of, you know, retaining the market and audiences that they've already developed over a period of time. And I think what this talked to was the fact that, you know, the consumer had moved on and the market was extremely saturated. I mean, if you went to any CNA or any distributor of these publications, you walk around there, you could literally, if you look on the shelves, I mean, you could just can't even distinguish what is what. So we were really oversaturated, I think, as an industry. And maybe COVID is forcing us to get into an environment where there should be some consolidation of sorts and, you know, giving the consumer a little bit of a respite to choose something much more discerning and much more accessible. The arena titles, I mean, we're suffering like everybody else. We've had to basically double down and look at the costs and make sure that, you know, we go through the first 3 months. The issue for us was uncertainty. We didn't know how deep that lockdown was going to be. Was it going to be 1 month or 2 months or 3 months? So that, you know, you can make some provisional planning and get over this, because as a bigger group, we could hold the costs for a little bit longer than, you know, marginal companies, which were obviously depending on one title or so to survive.
And I mean, what you touch on there are some very important commercial issues around cost, consumption and competition that I really want to expand on, because what we're seeing is digital lower the barriers. So it's bringing the cost down, the physical cost of printing a magazine, obviously one of the biggest cost components that digital now alleviates. But within that, Prof, how should proprietors be thinking about the brand equity and the brand value that they've built up in a lot of these titles over many generations? And I think of Drum, for example, and the late Jim Bailey that I referenced in my introduction. There's a lot of brand equity in that. So how should proprietors be thinking about pivoting into digital and not destroying a lot of that brand equity while dealing with the cost pressures and the lack of advertising and all of the things that Chris and Pule have raised?
Look, there's no question that if you look around the world at what's working and what's not working, it's those who are willing and able to invest in unique, trustworthy, valuable content that has succeeded in getting their readers to move to digital platforms and to pay as subscribers or members for that content. So if you look at The Economist, for example, or The New Yorker magazine, the great tragedy of much of our media has been that it's only been able to cut costs under pressure. But there's no question you have to get people to start paying for content. For that to happen, your content has to be unique and trustworthy. There's a greater demand and need for that than ever before. But that requires investment. It means not cutting journalists' jobs. It means paying journalists to produce great work that people are prepared to go find and pay for. So the model has to change. It takes experimentation, it takes time, it takes deep pockets. But if you look at The Guardian or The New Yorker or The Washington Post or The Wall Street Journal or The Financial Times, those publications that are succeeding, that's the path they've taken.
Absolutely. Investing in the newsroom and in the talent. And I think, Pule, I want to come back to you on that because that's directly within Arena's purview. And I want to quote one of your peers in the space, Terry Millman at Caxton, famously once said of journalists, they're just really there to fill up the space between advertising. And was rather dismissive of their role. But what the professor is saying is absolutely right. In a world where we have a fire hose of content, then consumers are going to be very discerning about who they read and what content they consume. And that means an investment in the team and in the right talent inside an organization. How are you approaching that at Arena?
I think the COVID thing as well showed that if you look at the major titles in the U.S., the readers went to those trusted brands. There was actually a bigger consumption, even on the physical papers. In Europe as well, that was also the trend. But you know, the issue of trusted brands can only be supplemented by quality journalism, and which is one thing that we subscribe to. I mean, as the new owners in the Arena environment, we've always said that that's the first thing that we wanna do. Want to make sure that, you know, we hire quality talent to basically reinforce the existing quality that we have in the newsroom, but also support the quality brands that we've purchased, because that was the attraction that came in the acquisition space. Not only do they are they quality brands, they have deep heritage. You know, it's one thing to have a quality brand, but another not to have that heritage. So we think that is going to be one of the things that is going to become a bit enduring for us. But we need to not just grow our own timber, but we need to appreciate the existing timber and attract quality individuals who can come in, because they, at the end of the day, the reader, the viewer, and the listener are basically looking for quality and talent. And that's what we basically are committing to do as new proprietors. We are having heavy cost structures. We are under pressure. We are not immune from what everybody else is going through. And that partly goes to that issue that I was talking about of the business model. The business model of major traditional newspapers and even groups is not sound. I mean, let's be fair. This situation has exposed the fault lines. The fault lines have always been there. And the prof will remember, especially with this group, they were, you know, they came from, their heritage came from being owned by a mining conglomerate. And there was a certain way of doing things and not preparing for, you know, the future. And I think we missed out maybe 10, 15 years ago. We could have repurposed this particular organization differently, and it would be flying differently right now. I mean, those are the things that, you know, we need to start thinking about. And we are really looking hard at ourselves as an organization to say, okay, what is it that we can do to innovate and basically ride through the storm? We managed the first 2 months very well, I thought. The third month, even our numbers were beginning to look much better. I mean, we are seeing green shoots. Advertisers are coming in. We're having bookings, long-term bookings that are coming up and stuff. But the cost base, you know, the fact that we managed to look at it, and we didn't cut people at that stage. You know, if you recall, we didn't do that. There was a big debate about that, but we went a different route of saying, let us all make a salary sacrifice from the executives right down to the bottom. You know, and you know, we are seeing the benefits of that because, you know, we are beginning to look a little bit agile.
In media in general now, Chris, when you see the changing behaviors and patterns of consumption of media, one thing that I've noticed now being in broadcast TV is that during lockdown, people obviously being at home could consume a lot more midday television programming. So it's not like everyone's losing here. Who are the big winners and losers thanks to the COVID-19 disruption?
Well, depends on what your perspective is and what a winner and a loser is, right? So I think from an ad revenue perspective, let's get that one out the way. There's not very many winners. There's very, very few winners, in fact. But in terms of audiences, I think the winners are, I think, two-part. I think television, we've seen television do very well. As you mentioned earlier on, midday television audiences have increased. Daytime television audiences have increased. And the irony is that they've actually done well despite having less content. We mustn't forget that a big driver of content on television viewing is sport. And we haven't had live sport really for 3 months now. We're starting to see sport dripping back, but I think that's a credit to platforms like SuperSport in terms of agility. We probably spoke about it a little bit earlier on in terms of what SuperSport have done as an example. They've started broadcasting sports movies at night, you know, at times when there isn't sport. So television is the one platform we saw that has grown. I mean, radio has also done well for itself. Radio also, from an agility perspective, we've seen a lot of the radio stations move their daytime audio, their morning drive DJs. From 6 to 9, now they're going from 7 to 10 or from 8 to 11, trying to change the concept of what we would traditionally consider drive time. And then the digital platforms. I think the digital platforms have all done really well from an audience perspective. We've seen platforms like Twitter. You know, there's enough news to talk about at the moment, right? So a lot of these platforms are growing big time in audiences. The guys that are struggling, we don't need to talk about the likes of Stat Kinney Court, you know, obviously movies only now being allowed back again. Out of home has really taken a beating because of, again, for obvious reasons. We're not out on the road. We're not looking at billboards anymore. And print, which we've spoken about.
And Prof, coming back to you there, the business model that Pula has also mentioned that needs to change to adapt to this, to adapt to a world where advertising revenues are dwindling. There's been all kinds of innovation. We've tried to put paywalls behind content, drip feeding free articles to drive paid for content online. We've seen paywalls go up and down. There just doesn't seem to be a single model here that in the South African media landscape has delivered what seems to be sustainable long-term success. What are your thoughts on how you see the business model evolving from here?
If you look around the world at the success stories, it is based on the consumer paying more for news media that matters to them. There's no doubt, whether it's a form of a subscription or a membership or a contribution, the success stories are those whose content is such that consumers can and will pay for it, and the cost base moves to the revenue base moves to what consumers are paying and less of a dependence on advertising. Advertising remains a factor and remains important, but that's the essential shift we're seeing in many places. And we're seeing people experiment here with so far limited success. We're seeing a Daily Maverick use a membership model, for example. We are seeing the Arena Group and using paywalls, subscription models. Our frustration is that in this country, there has been limited success, I must say, on those models. We have to ask why, and I believe it's because you have to be investing in content that people like us will pay for. And there are not many people doing that sufficiently yet. So it is a time of experimentation, and I should say that the other area in which is producing good, valuable, impactful journalism has been, to our great surprise, those supported by foundations and philanthropists.
Yeah.
So we see specialist, online, investigative and other news operations that have the support of philanthropic support, doing surprisingly well and doing very good and important work. So we really have to try all sorts of different models. And I will say, I will add that I'm not sure the market alone will solve this problem. So I do think we need to think as a society, as an economy, what needs to be done to sustain the news media industry we need so badly. And I'm not sure we can just rely on the market to solve those problems.
That's an interesting final point, and I want to address that, Pule, as well as to find out what you think the key is to cracking the model at the moment. It does also seem to me like you obviously have to diversify away from purely advertising or purely subscription to have a multi-pronged revenue model, be it eventing, the online webinars. I think we're drinking from the fire hose of webinars at the moment, but all of these things must supplement what has been a dwindling advertising pie.
Yeah, agreed. But for all the fanfare that everyone has been talking about on their move to digital, is that the digital spend is not enough to even justify the transition. So you could move, you could get into that space, but the advertising still forms the bulk of your business. That's where the challenge is. So you gotta have and go, you gotta go into a trade-off environment, which is very delicate that you gotta do. So I see this as a multi-year, multi-pronged type of approach that we need to engage on as a print media. And also to get back to the issue of news, you know, news is critical. It's significant for especially a fragile young democracy like ours. And I don't think that it is appreciated that much by, you know, at least our people and what have you. Because in the past, news has been commoditized. It was not priced accordingly to the consumer. And also, going back to the business model, our business organizations had also mediated or sort of, disaggregated themselves, you know, from owning the customer. There was never that direct relationship between the customer and the publications, because if you look at even the complicated distribution models that you would have, the prof would remember this. I mean, he comes from the Mail and Guardian era, and I come from a New Nation era, prof. We went through the same pain. And that's where also it brings me to another fear on the philanthropic model. Much as I appreciate it, I think it's a unique model. It's great, it's appreciated, every voice must add. But if we are going to lose the mainstream press and then also depend on philanthropy, then we are moving the pain from one area to another. We are not addressing the problem, because the philanthropist one day might just walk away. Then what? You know, we had it at New Nation where we were benefactors of the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. And when one day they decided, well, democracy is doing well, we are walking away. We couldn't survive. We have to shut down.
So that raises, again, more questions sometimes than answers. Chris, what do you see as the answer from an agency, an ad agency perspective? What are advertisers looking for that media proprietors can exploit and look to take advantage of at this time?
I think relevant content, right? And the prof spoke about it and Pule spoke about it. I think for us, all we're interested in content, whether that content gets transferred on print or on a billboard or on a screen, we don't really care. It's the content and the audience. The challenge that we're seeing at the moment, though, is that in 20, 30 years ago, if you were competing in an era like, let's use my old stomping ground. I come from Bloemfontein, so there's one newspaper. It's the Volksblad. You could choose between the Volksblad and the Volksblad. Now, no longer the Volksblad is no longer available. Why? Because now, with the online world, you can go, if you want to go get the Wall Street Journal, if you want to get the Washington Post, if you want to get the whatever newspaper you want, you can get it online. So the competition pool has increased by so much. So the challenge is for all of us as media and marketing and brand custodians is, how do we get platforms that offer unique content that is valuable, that consumers are willing to pay for.
and that's it's locally relevant as well. While you can go and shop anywhere in the world for any title, I think the one advantage we have is that local knowledge. We didn't even get to discuss some of those other interventions, such as what's going on in Australia, and the professor alluded to it, that they're planning to force Google and some of the other platforms to share some of that ad revenue to support their local media industry. And I think that's a very important conversation as well. But gentlemen, thank you very much. Some fantastic insights into the world of media, what's shifting, and how COVID-19 is accelerating many of those trends.